Chapter 8 Odyssey. After friends, after the movies, after the 6-year relationship, fall and rise and fall, after everything, for the next 6 years I found myself bound upon an odyssey. Contrary to how it might appear, I was not a man with a lot of money, with nothing much to do. In fact, I had more than ever to do. No. I was a man falling down a mountainside, lost in a raging river, hoping to find refuge on any safe, dry rock. Between Mr. Sunshine and Go On, I headed to Cirque Lodge in Sun Valley, Utah, rehab number 3 if you're scoring at home. The lodge sits at the base of Mount Timpanogos in the Utah Rockies. I'm not a big nature guy in terms of peaceful locations. I prefer the ocean, or at least a view of the ocean. But this place was stunning. The air was thin and true, razor-sharp, clarifying. There were turkeys all around, gobbling fit to bust, flying once in a while, too. Who knew they flew? And golden eagles, and some days a moose would wander by, heavy and slow. No, really, there were moose there. I wasn't hallucinating. Beyond its beauty, Cirque Lodge also boasted a crack staff. They knew what they were doing. My counselor, Burton, who, if his face was green, I would have sworn was Yoda, wound up being deeply helpful to me, with both the real problems I brought with me and the invented ones I carried with me at all times. He happens to be one of the men I ever said I love you to. I arrived very scared, a prerequisite for entering rehab, but deeply uncomfortable nonetheless. And Burton's soothing voice made me feel a teeny bit better, almost instantly. Discover, uncover, and discard was one of the major mantras at Cirque, and I was excited to think I could at least do that last one. It was time to get rid of all this shit, once and for all. At this point, I was such an expert on the 12 steps and everything else they tend to focus on in rehab. So much so that while at Cirque, I spent a lot of my time helping out the newbies and trying to have a little fun. I had a ping pong table brought in and even invented a game revolving around a red ball that we threw back and forth, all of which kept my fellow inmates enthused for hours on end and gave me a boost of purpose. I wanted to help so much. I was good at it. I was under the impression that during this stay, I was going to have to do deep trauma work, reaching back into my childhood, pulling up all the pain and loneliness, thereby beginning the very painful process of letting these things go. The idea was that if I got over these traumatic events, I would no longer feel the need to cover them up with drugs and alcohol. Burton, however, saw things differently. He accused me of liking the drama of my addiction and asked how I could have so much fun while at Cirque, yet be so troubled by almost everything that took place out there in the real world. This question was instantly offensive to me. I like this? How could Burton look at my decades of addiction and terror, my lack of control, my obvious inner torture, and say I liked it? During Family and Friends Week, it was normal for participants to invite people to come and visit. But I resisted it, hard. My father had visited me at Hazelden, my mother at Promises Malibu, and my then-girlfriend had spent countless hours witnessing me rant while detoxing with a myriad of home nurses and sober companions. I didn't want to put them through this yet again. It was too painful, too hard, too unfair. I wanted them to catch a break. It was the least I could do. I'd gotten myself into this mess, I'd get myself out. But one day, around the time of Friends and Family Week, I found myself sitting outside alone, hoping a moose would show up or a turkey doing its flappy thing up into the trees. The day was freezing cold, sub-zero, but I still needed to smoke, so there was nothing to do but bundle up and deal. As I sat there puffing on a Marlboro, a light snow began to fall, bringing on an intense hush, as though the universe was patiently listening to my head and heart. I wonder what the universe heard. I began to think about why I hadn't wanted any visitors during this day, and something profound hit me. Why am I excusing my family and loved ones from having to go through this hell, and not myself? With that thought, I realized that Burton's advice was right. I did like the chaos. It was time to give myself a break. Drugs hadn't given to me what I needed in a long time, yet I kept going back to them and risking my life in order to, what, escape? Escape from what? The worst thing I had to run away from was my alcoholism and addiction, so using drinks and drugs to do so. Well, you can see the logical impossibility. None of it made sense, not even in the slightest. I was smart enough to see that. Doing something about it, though, that was another level of math that I hadn't yet discovered. Change is still scary, even when your life is on the line. But at least I was finally asking good questions, even if the answers weren't entirely clear. I knew deep down that life is about the simple joys of throwing a red ball back and forth, of watching a moose lope across a clearing. I needed to let myself off the hook for all the things doing the damage, like still being angry with my parents, being unaccompanied, all those years ago, of not being enough, of being terrified of commitment, because I was terrified of the end of commitment. I needed to remember that my dad left because he was afraid, and my mom was a kid who was just doing her best. It wasn't her fault that she'd had to commit so much time to the fucking Canadian Prime Minister. It was never going to be a 9-to-5 job, even with a kid at home, but I couldn't see that back then, and here we are. I needed to move on and up, and realized that there was a whole big world out there, and it was not out to get me. In fact, it had no opinion about me. It just was, like the animals and the shiv-sharp air. The universe was neutral and beautiful and continued with or without me. In fact, I was alive in a world where, despite its neutrality, I had managed to create for myself an important, meaningful place. I needed to realize that when I died, I wanted my friends' credit to be way down on the list of things I had accomplished. I needed to remind myself to be nice to people, to have them bumping into me be a happy experience, not one that necessarily had to fill me with dread, as though that was all that mattered. I needed to be kind, to love well, to listen better, to give unconditionally. It was time to stop being such a scared asshole and realize that as situations come up, I would be able to handle them because I was strong. Eventually, the snow slowed, and out of the coming gloom, a moose silently bulked into the gardens. It was a female, that long face serene, as though it had seen everything at least once and wasn't fazed by anything. There was a lesson in that, I thought. Behind her, a couple of calves kept pace, filled with that energy only kids possess. They all looked at me, sitting there in the twilight, and then they turned and wandered away. Perhaps this was the lesson the universe was sending. I didn't matter, not in the great cosmic sense. I was just one more human being spinning in infinite circles. To learn that was enough. I stubbed out the Marlboro and headed back in to lead yet another game of Red Ball. I came out of Cirque Lodge thin and happy and ready to take on the world and ready to be with my girlfriend forever. But my then-girlfriend didn't like this new Maddie very much. I got the sense that she didn't appreciate it, that I needed her less than before. Perhaps my problems had created a sense of security for her. This guy will never leave me. No, while he's so wrapped up in his own problems. She didn't like that I was better. And that unfortunate truth was our final downfall. After trying hard to make the various pieces fit, we admitted defeat and broke up. It was very sad all around. She was my favorite person on the face of the planet. But it was not meant to be. It was the right thing. But that didn't mean it wasn't sad. Now what? Yet again. I filled the hole initially with activism, but in doing so I flew too close to the sun and managed to lose my last semblance of innocence. Back in 2001, I spent time in a rehab called Promises in Malibu, right after I'd first picked up AA's big book in Marina Del Rey. There I'd met a guy called Earl H. He'd been hosting a class at Promises, and I had liked him immediately. He was funny and incredibly knowledgeable about AA. He had several other celebrity clients who, too, were doing well. So I thought, he's my guy, and I asked him to sponsor me. He said he hadn't had a drink since 1980. Over coffee, I admitted that one of the concerns I had was that one day he'd pass me a script to read. He said, well, there is a script, but I wouldn't do that to you. So began our relationship. I worked the steps with him. In fact, I would chase him down to do them. I was so desperate to get with the program and stay sober that I would call him daily and ask to work. He claimed nobody had ever chased him harder, and over the course of the following 10 years, he came to wear two hats. He was my sponsor, but he was also my best friend. I looked up to him and listened to him. We had the same sense of humor and sort of even sounded the same. I ignored the fact that he was sort of famous in the rehab world, a world where everything's supposed to be anonymous. But my big mistake was that I sort of made him my higher power. If I had a relationship issue, if I had issues with anything, I would call him, and he would be very smart about it. I got to the point where if he'd said, I'm sorry, Matthew, but you have to move to Alaska and stand on your head, I would have immediately booked a ticket to Anchorage. If he said you could eat nothing but green M&Ms for the next 3 months, you can rest assured I would have been shitting khaki. Deep down, though, I knew full well that making your sponsor your best friend was a bad idea. But Earl was everything to me. He'd become my father, my mentor. I would go watch him speak. He was hilarious and a very effective speaker. We would go to movies together. I would have my relapses, and he would help finding me treatment centers. It's no exaggeration to say that he probably saved my life several times. And then our friendship turned into a business. Yes, I went into business with my sponsor. Fatal fucking mistake. Earl had started a company that was going to establish sober living houses around Los Angeles that he would run. I invested $500,000 in the company and turned my house in Malibu into a sober living place called Perry House. Along the way, at the behest of a great guy named Wes Huddleston, head of the National Association of Drug Court Professionals, Earl and I headed several times to Washington, D.C. to meet with lawmakers to push the efficacy of drug courts. Drug courts aim to decriminalize nonviolent addicts, offering them care and treatment instead of jail time. In May 2013, Gil Kerlikowske, then Obama's drug czar, even managed to give me a prize of a Champion of Recovery Award from the Obama administration's Office of National Drug Control Policy. I joked to the Hollywood Reporter at the time that had I been arrested, I would be sitting in prison somewhere with a tattoo on my face. I also hosted Piers Morgan Live the same month, talking to Lisa Kudrow and Lauren Graham, but also focusing on issues of addiction and recovery. I was trying to find out what I wanted to do moving forward, and I felt comfortable doing the show. I began by saying I was not Piers Morgan, and the way you could tell that for sure was that I don't have a British accent, I don't have a first name that sounds very pointy, which caused Lisa to giggle out loud. I thought, maybe this is my future. I even got to joke that my forthcoming autobiography would be called Still a Boy. Oops. Either way, I was now a talk show host and an award-winning addict. How the fuck did that happen? Earl had originally been slated to appear on Piers Morgan with me, but he bailed at the last minute. Still, we later headed to Europe to push the power of drug courts there, and I got to debate the issue on a late-night BBC news show called Newsnight. There was the moderator, a cranky guy called Jeremy Paxman, who was famous for being rude to guests. Baroness Meacher, who was the then chair of the UK All-Party Parliament Group on Drug Policy Reform, and deeply on my side. And then a complete tool called Peter Hitchens. I can't imagine what it's like to have a sibling whom everyone adores when you're the idiot brother everyone loathes. But I think Peter could well be able to weigh in on what that feels like. The loss of Peter's wonderful brother, the great Christopher Hitchens, still reverberates. An unmatched raconteur, writer, arguer, and bon vivant, and the whole world mourns Christopher still, more than a decade after his brutal death from cancer. Sadly, his younger brother Peter is still pontificating on things he has no idea about, mixing right-wing ideology with a kind of paternalism and moral tutting. Hitchens showed up on Newsnight to expound his bizarre views that drug taking is just a case of weak morals. There's an immense fashion at the moment, he sneered, for dismissing the ability of people to take control of their own lives and to make excuses for them, sounding like some insane great aunt who had one too many glasses of sherry. Even more bizarrely, he later argued that addiction isn't even a real thing. I like to think that both the Baroness and I ran rings around him. But frankly, that wasn't hard. Apart from pointing out that I thought he was going to show up wearing big boy pants to the interview, but he clearly hadn't, I also managed to point out repeatedly that the American Medical Association had diagnosed addiction as a disease in 1976, and that he was about the only person on the planet who didn't agree with that assessment. He didn't like that very much, and eventually the interview ended with Paxman and Baroness Meacher simply laughing out loud at how stupid and cruel Hitchens sounded. Hitchens. So how is it that people ever cease to be addicts if what you say is true? Me. Well, Santa. Hitchens. Yeah, that's terribly clever, but this is a very serious subject, and you treat it with immense levity. Proving, I suppose, that he knew nothing about me or the subject on which he pontificated. Meanwhile, even though I'd made Peter Hitchens look like the fool he is and advocating for drug courts all over Europe, stateside, Perry House was floundering. Not enough people attended. It was simply too expensive, so I had to cut my losses and sell the property. When I had lunch with Earl, I asked for my money back. And I'm still waiting. He was talking about crazy things, like maybe becoming an actor. Something was off, and I was so freaked out by the whole thing. Well, I went home and used. This was no one's fault but my own, but two things were crucially lost forever. My innocence and my trust in Earl H. Eventually, Earl moved to Arizona without even telling me. And our friendship was over. From sharing our lives and being best friends and advocating for drug courts and building a sober living home, I'd lost $500,000. My closest ally and that innocence I'd cherished all those years. Heartbreak. I had been writing television for years, but always with a partner. The day after the Earl H. debacle, I was feeling especially uncomfortable and ill at ease, and I remembered that a wise man once told me that in times like this I should be creative. So I opened up my laptop and started typing. I didn't know what I was typing. I just kept typing. It became apparent that what was coming out was a play. I needed this. I'd recently let my standards down horribly, and I was determined to crawl my way back to something closer to being able to contemplate looking in the mirror. I was angry at myself over what had happened on The Odd Couple on CBS. For a long time, I'd been a huge fan of the film of Neil Simon's play and had always wanted to do a TV version of it. My dream came true. In 2013, when CBS had finally greenlit the idea, Go On, the show I did before The Odd Couple hadn't worked, but I felt more confident about this one. The source material was brilliant, the cast great, everything was set fair to have a hit. Yet depression stalked me, and my addictions were back in full force. Accordingly, I'm completely embarrassed about my behavior on The Odd Couple. On top of the horrible depression, I showed up late all the time, and high, and ultimately lost all power on the show to a showrunner. But I take complete responsibility for what happened, and I would like to apologize not only to my fellow castmates, but also to everyone involved. With that disaster in the rear view, I had a play in hand, at least. Feeling that dis-ease, that discomfort coming out of my skin, usually I would use drugs to replace it, to give myself ease. But I was sober now, so I knew I couldn't do that. I had to find something else. I wrote 10 hours a day for 10 days straight until I had completed the play. And it was actually kind of good, according to the very few people I let read it. It's called The End of Longing, and though it had taken 10 days to draft, I'd spend another year perfecting it. I'd been inspired by, and when I say inspired, I mean trying to beat, sexual perversity in Chicago, and was happy with what I'd achieved. I'd put it up against that fine play any day. In describing what I was trying to do, I'd told The Hollywood Reporter that there's a very popular notion that people don't change. But I see people change every day, and I wanted to put that message out there while making people laugh. Accordingly, the play finds four friends in a bar trying to discover love. My character, Jack, opens the play as an egomaniac who happens to be an alcoholic, and then it only gets worse. Me being me, I was not content to have just written a play. I decided it needed to be staged and have me in it. Months later, The End of Longing premiered in London's hallowed West End theater district. I loved being the playwright, as well as the lead. I could change things around when they weren't working. And though I knew I'd hate doing the big drunk scene every night, it was surely going to be intensely triggering, but I had to show just how low a person can go. We opened in Playhouse Theater, an 800-seat venue, and quickly we were selling out. In fact, we were pulling down massive box office records, but also lousy reviews. For historical accuracy, there were 7 major reviews. 6 of them were bad. London reviewers didn't like the idea of Hollywood actor boy going over there and doing a play. It was a huge success, though, and I was a playwright. I liked that idea. There was also one person who wouldn't come to the play, even though I begged. The woman I dated for 6 years was by now dating a British guy, and they were spending half the year in London, the rest in Los Angeles. We were still friendly enough that we had a couple of lunches and texted a few times. Knowing she was in London, I invited her to see The End of Longing. But she texted back that she was way too busy. "I'll see you stateside," she wrote. I replied that I was a little hurt that she couldn't make it. The play was being performed in her town, for God's sake. And then a while later, I got an email telling me that she was getting married and that she had no room in her life for friends. I never replied to that email, and we've never spoken since. It was an incredibly harsh way to reveal the news that she was getting married, and not something that I would ever do to a person. But there you have it. Even still, I will forever be planted in her corner. I'm glad she got married and that she's happy. I want nothing but the best for her. Forever. From London, the play moved to New York. That was not fun. For a start, I had to tone the play down. The Brits didn't care about the salty language, but Broadway is Broadway, so I had to leaven it. And not just the language, I had to kill a bunch of the jokes, too. So it was neither well-received nor beloved in New York. The New York Times trashed it, calling it synthetic, whatever that means. And I ended up making $600 for the whole New York run. That's not a typo. I'd made 1,000 times more, almost to the pound, shilling, and pence during its run in London. At least The Hollywood Reporter was nice about it. Perry at least demonstrates that his extensive television comedy experience has rubbed off. The evening features many amusing one-liners, most of them predictably delivered by the author. Perry displays his familiar expert comic timing and delivery. But the at least was pretty crushing, and I realized that The End of Longing wasn't going to be beloved enough to cement my future as a budding David Mamet. But there's still time.